have a friend, for example, who was controlling someone's bank account entirely. You know, mom is still very like, that's not very ladylike. British girls, they were quite mouthy. By the time they're 13, they'd already lost their virginity. It was like a race. Today, you will get chlamydia. I just wanted to have sex, you know?
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the third episode of the Old Collective podcast. We are Eden, Diana, Winxie, and Simona, and we're all about female intimate wellness and pleasure. As modern third culture kids, we thought it can be helpful to share our stories and our guests' experiences around sex and intimacy for anyone out there to navigate their way through life, sex, and relationships. Today, we're chatting with Hua Hua. She is a British Chinese artist with an unconventional third culture kid background. She dropped out of university where she was originally studying philosophy and art history to pursue a lifestyle as an artist. She worked across different industries from film, Amnesty International, sex work, gallery work, and more. Today, she's the co-founder of Borderline, a platform dedicated to rope art and activities in China. She believes that rope bondage is a process of exploring our authenticities. Tune in to hear more about what it's like learning about her sexuality growing up in the UK with Chinese parents, how she got into shibari rope art, what she has learned throughout her career in shibari, and how shibari can benefit overall intimate sexual wellness for all. Hey, Hua!
Hey.
Can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up? What are your roots? And what got you into shibari?
Yeah, what got me into shibari is kind of a long story, but I'm originally from the UK. So I'm British Chinese. My parents emigrated to the UK. I was born and raised there, and for a short time as a teenager, I lived in Hong Kong as well. But I only got into shibari when I moved to Shanghai about 6 years ago. So even though like I'm from London, which is a big cultural capital, and it's a big BDSM capital as well, where it's probably much easier to work in this field and to focus in this field. For some reason, I just picked it up whilst I was in China instead. So before I did shibari, I was very much interested in performance art. So I'd kind of like dabbled with a lot of different things. I knew that I had a lot to express, but I didn't really know exactly what kind of medium fitted me. When I was younger, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be a writer. So I even dropped out of university to look into film schools. And I was just dabbling for a couple years. And then I ended up focusing on doing stuff that was more to do with my body. I figured using my own body seems to be the most truthful kind of canvas I can do, and a lot of things that I can express I'm in control of. It's not like picking up a paintbrush and learning how to paint, right? It's like just exploring what you have already. So I started with doing a lot of performance art and also doing a lot of nude photography. So I was already quite open-minded as to explore myself, explore my sexuality, explore the idea of being seen as well. And then I found shibari kind of around the same time as I started working more in this field, and I started getting interested in learning more and learning about different subcultures too. And I happened to actually just meet a guy on Tinder as well who was kinky. And that same day that we had a date, he took me to meet some people who were interested in BDSM. So it's kind of a lucky chance.
Wasn't it scary then, the first time you meet up and then this guy takes you to a BDSM party?
No, not really. Yeah. It's not really a BDSM party. It was more just like people were meeting up at a bar and chatting. But I had known about BDSM before, and I've always been kind of kinky. So I've always been, I'd put it in a way that I'm more creative in my sexual life. So I wasn't necessarily trying to like channel some sort of power role or specifically get into a certain tool. I was just very playful in my sex life. So I never found it kind of scary, the idea of doing BDSM. I just kind of didn't really care to look for it.
Was this in London? Where you discovered this all, or was this already in China?
No, this was here. And I think there's a reason why it's here, because London is a very large city, and a lot of these cities in Europe are very cultured, but the cultures are not necessarily crossing over. So they have their own spaces, they have their own clubs, they have their own forums, they have their own websites, they have their own social media. So you never really just happen across this stuff unless you're really interested. But I feel like here in Shanghai, like it's a big city, but it feels small, right? So you happen across things much easier. And I feel like nowadays that Shibari is very popular. People happen across it at a club night, you know? And you would never get that in London. Like, unless you went looking for bondage, you're not going to accidentally happen across it. So it kind of made sense that, like, I would feel more comfortable and have more access to it here in some ways.
Oh, wow. I've never bumped into Shibari except for when I bumped into you, when you told me you had an exhibition. Do you think that your upbringing back in Europe has influenced your view on sex and intimacy or your interest?
Growing up in London, it did help me a lot feel more able to be quite open about talking about sex. My mum is never really that happy with how loud I am about talking about sex or sex lives or I don't know, just different BDSM things I've come across. I'm very open about talking about this with my sisters and my family, but my mom is still very like, that's not very ladylike. Like, they still have that traditional upbringing, but they couldn't really do much about it. Like, I'm already a lost cause, you know, I was born and raised in the UK, so whatever. I think that had affected me. And I feel like if you meet British girls, they're quite mouthy about sex. Like, they're not very shy about talking about it.
Yeah,
so, I never really had an issue about that. It was more that I did have some sort of like shame oriented towards it. Like, I would feel like I should be open because people around me are more open. But then I would also feel some guilt and some shame. And I'd still have this effect from my mother where I'd be like, this is very unladylike. This is not very attractive to talk about sex. This is not so attractive when trying to find a partner. They want someone who's more demure and, you know, a little bit more shy about this stuff. Like, that's more attractive. So I was always kind of back and forth, like, should I be public like this, or is this gonna backfire on me?
Do you think that is also because of your Asian heritage, Asian background, or do you think that is because you are a woman?
I think that's both, very much both. I grew up in an all-girls school originally, so I didn't really have much access to talking with boys about sex. I talked with girls about sex, and girls talked a lot about it. But I guess we all probably had that, even whether or not you were come from an Asian background or not, is that your parents didn't want you to show this crude side to men. And I did also have this kind of weird imposter syndrome feeling when I was younger, because I would make friends with guys, or I'd have a lot of like dates with people, and they were like, oh, you're like one of the guys, you know, you can talk about sex, you can talk about girls, you can do all of this. And to me, it felt kind of odd, you know, it's like they like this as a friend, but is this something that they appreciate actually when it comes down to dating? And I noticed when I was younger, a lot of young guys, you know, teenagers or whatever, they tend to separate it, like, this is more of a friend thing. As a teenager, you don't think that. There's definitely ways to be. I definitely talked way more about sex than I was having it.
But do you guys also think it's like because guys at that age are also probably quite insecure themselves, so when they hear you so confidently talking about it, and they probably self-reflect and realize, wow, she's so experienced while I'm not, versus them actually not being into you? Because I feel like at least the older I get, even though, yes, my mom did tell me all that, but I don't want to feed into, hey, you shouldn't talk so much about sex because people will view you differently. It's more like, hey, maybe it is because they don't know how amazing it is. They don't know what kinky means. They don't know how amazing sex could feel. So instead of us being afraid of being judged, it's more like, maybe you should learn more about sex And maybe it is your uneducated sense with sex that you will view me in a negative way versus, oh, maybe they don't like me because I talk about sex a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing that I feel girls have so much more thought into this. They get so self-conscious about the idea of this, and actually guys don't tend to think about that as much, about their image being portrayed related to how open they are towards sex. And I think it's true, like they do, there's some, in some cases, especially like young boys, they find it kind of scary often the time, and women tend to talk more about it with each other. But cis straight males don't tend to talk with their male friends about sex. They talk more about it as if some kind of like winning, you know, like, oh, I fucked this girl last night. But they don't really go into the nitty gritty details, how it felt, all of the details that women do. So they don't actually get that education. Whereas women tend to teach each other from talking about each other's experiences, and guys tend to get most of their education through porn. So there is that disconnect, and when a guy comes across a girl who is very educated and very loud about sex, often they do find that intimidating. I do also think that people still, I'm not so sure if it has a big relevance here necessarily, but definitely when I was in the UK, this kind of Madonna horror complex where they are both really attracted to this like incredibly sexual creature, but then when it comes to marriage or when it comes to a committed relationship, they want this like virginal girl who's like never had like all these crazy experiences before, and you can be their first and whatever. So I still think a lot of people have this issue too.
I think this is part of our society. It's not even Asian or European anymore, but I see this both here, like when I'm in the Netherlands, I see this here, and also going back to Asia, I see it there as well. It's really rooted in our society, this thinking that you can have some fun, but if you want to settle down with a partner, that partner needs to be Virgin Mary.
Yeah, I definitely found that going on Tinder dates, especially when I already like fully started doing Shibari. So I couldn't have any other opening line, you know, when people are like, oh, what do you do? It's like, oh, I teach people how to tie people up. So it became a point where, like, I think a lot of people got thrown off at the fact that, like, what I do is takes certain amount of sexual awareness and sexual experience, and people were kind of, like, not really sure how to continue dating in the way that they normally would do.
So, we were talking about shame earlier, how growing up you felt shame when it comes to, you know, understanding your own self-pleasure. How do you think you overcame that?
I don't know. I think part of kink is also part of my way of working through a lot of these early issues towards shame and sexuality. And I think that is actually why so many people are kinky, is because we have a lot of these conventional ideas of how to be sexual. But a lot of your desires and things are not well accepted. So rather than like just trying to fight it all the time, is you get some sort of thrill out of the shame too. So I definitely think that has been part of my interest as well in Shibari, or even I liked it when I was doing nude photography a lot, is that there's something kind of exciting about the fact that it's not allowed really, or something that I was taught is kind of dirty or wrong. There's something exciting and thrilling about that. So I kind of worked through it by just being like the opposite and just rebelling against all of my upbringing that taught me what I am naturally is shameful. So I definitely had a huge rebellion phase, and now I think I've calmed down a bit from then.
Is it, I'm wondering right now, because you just said that you went to an all-girls school and then you come from a Chinese background, and I see Chinese background, to me, it's almost equivalent to being strict and having very traditional norms and values. Do you think that with the Chinese background and going to an all-girls school, that that kind of fired your rebellion? That made you want to rebel?
I guess, but I think I don't know if you know anyone from an all-girls school, but all-girls schools are pretty wild. Like, I think they've got this pressure because they're not allowed to be around boys, that they are obsessed about boys. And you
How
see
old
girls
were you, by the way?
wearing their thongs, like, so it sticks out of their skirts, doing what they can to express their sexuality. And it's really interesting. Like, they made separated schools. It was a Catholic school specifically to, like, eradicate the sex out of your education. And it made people more hungry for it. So I think it kind of encouraged me more than it took away my sexuality or brought more shame to me.
Or made you actually more, what is it? Liberal with it, it seems.
Yeah, I remember just when I left that school in middle school. So a lot of girls, by the time they're 13, they'd already lost their virginity. It was like a race. Like, they were, like, desperate to do it and they wanted to share it. And it was like a trophy thing. So yeah, I think all girls' schools is a pretty sexual environment to be in.
Do you have any fun facts or fun stories from your times back then about you and sexuality and being maybe in an all-girls school?
I remember learning how to kiss with each other. It was really messy. There'd be, like, one girl who had a lot of experience with boys from the... We had, like, a brother school. And she would, like, tell us, like, different ways how to kiss. And she's like, you can't, like, make circles with your tongue. Because if you make circles with your tongue, then it's likely to, like, get stuck in their teeth. So you have to, like, dig. She was like, you have to, like, dig it in and out. And then we're like, oh, how do we do that? And we would do it to each other. And she's like, you get it? And I was like, I don't really understand, but I'm just going to remember this forever.
Going back to your upbringing and to an all-girls school, how did you educate yourself? Or how were you educated about sex and relationships and intimacy, except for the one-on-one personal experiences you had with the girls? Did they teach you about sex at school?
I think school, for me, luckily enough, my school in Hong Kong and my school in UK, I was only there till middle school, so... I can't remember so clearly. I just remember they had, like, a biology lesson with a cartoon of a man penetrating a woman. That was probably the maximum amount of sex education that we had. And then when I was in Hong Kong, I remember one of the big standout things was Hong Kong was a mixed school. So it was my first time being in a school around boys. And I remember one of the teachers, she tried to hold a sex education talk for the whole school. And she made a statement, which I will always remember, going, one day you will get chlamydia. Okay,
what?
Don't think about it. It will happen. And when it happens, you've got to accept it. And everyone was, like, shocked. And everyone laughed about her for ages and ages. And then I remember when I got chlamydia, I was like, oh, damn, she was right. But it was really, like, I don't know, it was really strong of her to go up in front of a bunch of kids who can't take this stuff seriously and try to talk about STDs. And she was trying to talk about them in a way that makes it clear that these things happen. They're normal. They do happen, but you need to know how to, one, prevent it and know what to do when it happens, you know? So I think I was quite lucky that my education in school at least helped me be aware of the fact that there are these things. So I remember the first time I had sex, I would go to the clinic by myself. And in the UK, when I went back to the UK, it's free. So I could go to the clinic, I could get tested. So every single time I had a new partner, I got into that habit. And I realized, talking to a lot of my friends here in Shanghai, is like, that is really inaccessible to them. So the idea of an STD is something that they think is really dirty, but also they're so afraid to find out if they have one. Whilst for a lot of girls in the UK, it's quite common that every time you get a new partner, you just go to the clinic.
Yeah. That's amazing. Can you do it even when you're under 18 as well?
Yeah, definitely. They give you a lot of pamphlets and everything. But I think the legal age for sex is 16 in the UK.
So if you're under 16, you can also go get checked?
Yeah, you can. You can. I think the only thing is if you have an abortion, you need to have a legal guardian present. That's it.
Awesome. Yeah, like in China, even till this day, I believe if you're not married and you would like to get a pap smear, you need to pay for it yourself. You don't get it for free.
Yeah, and definitely. And you get a lot of shame from the people who work there.
And also, like, I remember because I wanted to get a pap with my, like, yearly health tests. They were like, sorry, ma'am, if you want to get it done, you need to pay extra for it. I was like, you kidding me? I'm 31.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I always get shocked by that. But a lot of countries, you still have to pay for these kind of treatments. And for me, I was kind of blessed that we had free healthcare in the UK.
Yeah, for sure. It's very unfair, I'd say, for women, especially when you have like diseases like HPV and
Did you have a shot for that? I had a shot for that when I was 12.
I did. I had it when I was 18, but still, like, I still got HPV because there's so many different strains. I got guarded against 9 different HPV strains. So those are like the more highly cancerous ones and the dangerous ones. But then the ones that I got was, I believe, number 51 or 55, I don't remember.
There's so many different ones.
But still, like, it's so common, and I guess it comes and goes. And I remember 2 years ago when I got it, I was quite shocked. Because I was like, oh, I'm guarded against it. How come I still have it?
Yeah, that they have more of this education about this stuff because it's so easy to catch these things.
Totally.
But we just don't understand them. We also don't understand the risk. We also don't understand which one is worse than the other.
Yes.
So I'm glad that I had these free clinics and I would just read through the pamphlets. But I know a lot of girls, I mean, if they didn't want to go, they didn't have to go. So they didn't know. Yeah. So information was out there in the UK, but it doesn't mean that everyone is reading it.
Definitely.
Same in the Netherlands. How old were you when you went to the clinics or started to have sex?
I actually did a lot of playing around, and then I only lost my virginity when I was 17, which I remember I was really ashamed of. I was super ashamed of it because a lot of my friends had lost it earlier.
So you're ashamed of it because you lost it much later?
Yeah, because I was so interested in sex since I was like 13. I was talking about everything. Like, I wasn't really I never dated anyone in high school. I think I bloomed a lot later because a lot of my interest in some ways, like we were talking about, kind of scared a lot of guys. Like, they were kind of wanted to have like teenage romance with me, but I just wanted to have sex, you know, like I just wanted to try all of these things that I'd heard of or that I'd sneakily watched in porn, you know, like I was really curious and I wanted to like build up all these experiences, partially from my own curiosity, but also I think a kind of ego thing. And I think a lot of people were not interested about that around my age. They wanted to hold hands and go to the movies, and I didn't really know how to do that stuff.
You were also, it seems that you were far more ahead of most of the people your age, because you're also, I think I'm super vanilla because you're saying that you were watching porn.
One time it was Christmas and my family like went back to sleep, they were drunk. We had Sky TV. I don't know if it was Sky. Yeah, and I would go through the end channels, and then that was my first time I discovered porn. So it was when everyone was sleeping and I was watching those channels, and then I remember flicking back to like a safe channel before I went to sleep to make sure no one knew. But that was like my first access to porn. But it's so easy for a child to find that. If you don't have a parental lock on your TV guide, then they could just flick all the way to the dirty channels. And I'm a curious child, so I definitely delved into looking at porn. And I think internet, really, like being able to have access to the internet. Also having older siblings, I think that makes a difference.
How? They tell you about porn?
I think when they're going through things, I wanted to go through things that they were doing as well. So that's why I was thinking ahead. Like, I wanted to be beyond my age because I wanted to do what my sisters were doing. So I think that really affected my drive to lose my virginity, my drive to get involved with things that I was definitely not prepared for.
Hua, you mentioned earlier that you got into Shibari through kind of like a Tinder date and then a project that you had when you were working on. How did you start pursuing it as a career, and why China?
Well, when I got to Shanghai, I came to Shanghai because of a breakup. So I was in a very experimental time in my life where I wanted to make a huge change. So maybe if I didn't come at that time, I wouldn't have been so open-minded to start doing Shibari, especially Shibari professionally. When I came here, I was like, I just want to do something creative. I've been sitting on a lot of ideas for so long, but I never felt like I was able to do them. I think that was also because I was never taught that I should be doing any of this stuff. My parents were very much like, you need to get a good solid education, get a good job, and then maybe as a hobby you could do it on the side. And I didn't like the idea of waiting to do something that I wanted to do and spending years doing something just to appease them. So when I came here, I was like, okay, I have to. If I don't start now, then I'm going to end up having to get some shitty job that I don't like. So first I did a lot of videography, then I got involved with kind of an underground art collective here called the Basement Six. Then when I found it, it just felt like it clicked pretty well. Like, it was kind of crafty, like it involved work with my hands. It had some aesthetic about it, but it also had a lot to do with the human body. It also had a lot to do with intimacy and communication. So I was like, this is just so much better than everything else I've been doing. So I definitely came from it without much of this concept of it as a sexual thing. I just really liked the idea of doing something that I thought was fun. And it was a nice thing that I could do with people as well. It wasn't a lonely creation. It's something that you do in collaboration with someone else and in celebration of their body and of their emotions that they're giving to you. So really, it was one time I saw a girl from Hong Kong who came and she did a very secret little workshop in an Airbnb. And I was just amazed that you could create such intense intimacy with someone that you just met. And it's not really about sex, really. It was just physical touch. It was just being very aware of each other's emotions, and everything was nonverbal, and it just kind of amazed me. So from then on, I was like, I'm quitting everything else. I'm just going to focus on Shibari.
Is there any arousal? Because you said there's no sexual attention. Arousal is part of that, or isn't it?
Definitely sex is part of it, for sure. So the first time that I got tied up was really exciting, because it's arousing because someone is paying so much attention to you. I think that was the main thing that I found so stimulating about it. Like, never in my sex life has anyone been so aware of my entire body. All of my reactions, all of my sensitive spots. I didn't even know these areas were sensitive before I started doing Shibari. There's many situations where you might tie the whole body. So you'll be able to touch parts of the body and really focus on specific crevices and areas of the body that you maybe overlook when you're having sex, or even you're massaging or you're touching yourself. So it brought awareness to a lot of parts of my body that I didn't know could be a stimulating part. And also having someone watch you, you know, having someone look at you and look at you in a way that you're kind of helpless to prevent them from looking at you as well can be really sexual. It could also be kind of shameful. It can also be kind of terrifying, but it's intense no matter what. And I think generally this whole idea of Shibari as an excuse to touch each other, you know, often we leave physical touch to sex only. But there are so many ways that you can connect with people. You can get arousal, but also just intimacy with people by having the ability to touch each other more. So I think Shibari is, for many people, just a nice excuse to touch each other.
Oh, definitely. This actually sounds like a very good sales pitch to anybody who wants to rediscover touch, I feel. Mm. Like, if you are like in a relationship for, I don't know, an X amount of years with somebody, and then everything starts to being a routine, this just sounds like it. Like, rediscover yourself, rediscover touch, rediscover the places that you didn't know were sensitive to you or your partner.
Yeah, definitely. So it's nice to be on both sides of that too. Like, I think rope is a very empathetic thing for me. Like, I love the feeling of being tied, and it's something that I like to share with other people. So that's what really drives me as well to tie. But also, I think not only was it just about touching and being intimate, it was, I think before I did Shibari, I had a lot of intimacy issues. So it felt nice to like be in control and be able to do things the way I wanted to, and be able to connect with people in a way that was kind of my own language, you know?
Do you think there is a specific type of person or group of people who should practice Shibari or that are interested in Shibari?
I don't know. I think it's hard to say because there's so many different types of ways of tying, and they basically can fit whatever mood or whatever feeling or relationship you have with that person. Rope is basically a tool. It's just a very, very flexible tool. So many people can enjoy it in different ways. I do see that when people come with their own partners, it is easier for them to enjoy more of the aspects of Shibari than, for example, if they are doing this with a stranger. So a lot of people who are interested in Shibari are couples who already have built up some trust and intimacy. And it's a nice way to explore a different way to communicate with each other, a different way to play with each other. But also for some people, it's innate. Like a lot of the, especially the older generation who come to see me for just sometimes even to chat, they often have more difficulty in explaining it. Like they have more difficulty in explaining their interest in Shibari. Like I think they have much more shame and a lot more of this view of it being something very underground. But whenever I ask them, they're like, I just knew since I was like a kid, like whether that was as a child watching like some sort of TV show where there's a prisoner being tied up or using your jump rope to tie each other up. They just knew they had this urge to do rope since young. Or even, for example, me, I really loved hanging upside down. I loved it. I loved hanging upside down on the monkey bars until like my head was rushing. Or even I love like squeezing myself into very small spaces. Like I really enjoyed that. I used to like try and fit myself into the locker and just like hide there.
Like, oh my God, no, that's my worst dream ever. Okay. Yeah.
I think a lot of people's interest in BDSM is just this natural feeling of different types of play, but you get taught the shame around it as you grow older. But as a kid, if you look at a lot of children, they're naturally doing things that are kind of kinky, right? They just don't really have any conscience about it. They don't really care. They just do it.
They don't know it's kinky.
Question to this, do you then believe everyone has some sort of kink?
I believe everyone has the ability to do things out of the normal conservative view of what sex is. I think the problem is that we have such a strict idea of what sex should be that it makes a lot of people feel maybe they think they're not interested in sex, you know? I have a lot of people who come up to me and they're like, I just don't think I'm that interested in sex. And I was like, that's because you're probably just doing the same old routine. And you might have more interest in other ways, you know? And there's so many ways to enjoy intimacy. For example, like we often think of it as penetration, but penetration is so related to like a cisgender having sex with each other, and that's the way they normally do. But if you look in towards more queer communities, sex is a completely different way, right? And that's what I really liked about doing rope too, was that it felt like it made my sexuality seem more clear to me. That sometimes I'm not really turned on by penetration, or I'm not really turned on just by like traditional concept of fucking. I really like the touching, I really like the closeness, the breath, or the tightness of the body. You're putting bodies into positions. Like there's so many ways you can get turned on, but we're only taught a very small box of what it could be.
Yeah, there are these people that they say that they are asexual or different types of sexual. You have demisexual, you have sapiosexual, where they're only attracted to people who are intelligent. Do you think that the people who think they're not so sexual, they should actually dip their toes into Shibari or roping or other forms?
You can see Shibari in a non-sexual light too. So there's definitely, I have friends who identify as asexual and they're interested in Shibari. There's definitely ways to play in so many ways that to do with intimacy and touch where people can not feel a sexual urge from. But it's about us being more accepting of how many different ways people can view things that make it easier for you to do anything, really.
Do think there's a difference between Shibari that you practice right now in Shanghai versus the rest of the world or Europe or wherever you've experienced it?
I think no, because a lot of things are influenced from each other. Maybe beforehand, which doesn't include me, the Chinese community was more limited from access to information. So all of the information that they could get was from the few people who do teach, which was very underground, or through Japanese porn. So that was their main access. But since I started teaching classes about, I don't know, 2017, and another friend of mine started doing events in Shanghai, it kind of blew up around China, and a lot of people had access to different teachers around the world. They started learning about different classes, different studios. They started inviting people in, doing live stream classes. They started treating it as something that can be overground, right? And for that reason, a lot of the styles have become what you see outside of China too. So definitely, I think before we started doing our events, it was different. It was very different. Chinese bondage had its own kind of flavor that wasn't very much influenced by Japanese shibari. It wasn't influenced by Western bondage. It was kind of their own thing. But since we started doing classes, everything's kind of meshed.
You see some of a type coming to your classes, or is it just different?
Everyone's different. Everyone's different for sure. I do find that, like, for a lot of BDSM community, not necessarily to my classes, but a lot of people who are interested in BDSM do tend to have, like, a very conservative or not very alternative way of living. So I think for them, BDSM is a necessary way to release this pressure. So a lot of them have classic office jobs. They have wife and children. They have done everything the way they should be doing, you know? And that's what's made them kind of have this built-up urge to do something that is so drastically opposite. So that was generally a lot of the crowd. I see the majority of BDSM community all around the world, in honesty, comes from this. And that's why BDSM tends to excel in big pressure cities like Shanghai, London, Tokyo, New York. This is why a lot of people are interested in BDSM, because they have this high pressure lifestyle. So I do find a lot of people do come from that, but Shanghai is a very fun and creative city. So a lot of people have maybe some experience with dance, or maybe they're just more sexually active and they want to do different types of things to include in their sex life. Or they're artists themselves. So I do think now it's changing, but the first people who came to my events who had been super interested in this but never had a way to try it were very much people who lived a classic life that is very stable.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I was just reading a book called Mating in Captivity. And have you ever had any client where maybe it was the male or female that was coming in to you as a client, and then their other partner found out, and then their partner disagreed with what they're actually participating in?
Yeah, this is a conversation that I've been having as well. So I have recently someone who's been taking lessons online with me, just discussing about the history and the culture, safety and things like this. And we've been discussing online because for a long time, he's very interested in bondage specifically, and especially being tied. And he's tried always with his wife to get her to tie him, but she's not interested herself. And he feels like it's kind of like he's forcing her. But whenever he brings up the conversation of trying it with someone else, and even she can be present to watch, it's something that she completely disagrees with. And this is a common problem that I have faced among a lot of people who have come to see me to get tied, or they haven't even had the conversation with their partner. there's a lot of shame and there's a lot of rejection towards this idea. It seems very transgressive and seems you've got something mentally wrong with you. So a lot of people do hide it, or they have a major fear of rejection from their partner if they share this interest. So I have had that a lot. I haven't personally had an issue where the partner will find me and get angry with me. It's usually directed at the partner themselves. And I'm very clear with people when they come to me for a Shibari session that I do this professionally. We have an experience in this time where I tie you, and whatever feelings come out, I can allow that to happen. But I'm not looking for a romantic partner. I'm not looking for a sex partner through this. I just enjoy tying you. So I make that very clear to people, and people are very respectful for me because I'm clear about that. But I do know that a lot of people who do BDSM sessions or things like that, the line becomes kind of blurry.
Ask this question because I guess in every couple, people view infidelity quite differently. To some couple, that to them probably already feels like infidelity because it's stepping out of their own personal boundaries.
Yeah.
Their partner's looking for it. So I find that extremely interesting because after, like, myself even just learning a little bit more about it, of like why people want to have that maybe 1 hour to feel outside of their own body, outside of their own mind, it's a sense of relief and from reality as well. After knowing that more, to be honest, like in the past, I would say, oh, if you cheat on me, it's an immediate, or if I think a certain thing that you're doing is infidelity to me at this point, I would have just break it. But now, after understanding more about it, there's probably some underlining reason why people are seeking like this type of, whether it's BDSM or it is like paid sex work or such. So,
and also, in my opinion, like, I'm not polyamorous, but I'm definitely not monogamous in terms of my view of sexuality and intimacy. In my opinion, like, a lot of the times the issue is that we see our partner as the provider of everything for you. But no one can fulfill everything for you. And it's natural that you do get some sort of feelings or urges that aren't even sexual. They can just be intimacy, right? With other people. And Shibari is definitely an intimate act, but it's very much a contained experience too. And a lot of people, they just like the feeling, not related even at all to the person doing it. So it's quite normal for you to want to be tied by someone but not have any romantic feeling for them or any interest in them outside of that. But if you're not really involved in the same way in Shibari as your partner, it's very hard to see it that way. It just seems like you're cheating or you like that person. So I can definitely understand where they come from, but I can also feel for a lot of people who have kinky urges and things like that, and they love their partners, but they don't want their partners to feel pressured to do that, for one. And two, they want to be able to explore that maybe with someone who is professional and who knows how to do it and who is safe to do that. So it's a hard thing to negotiate in a relationship, definitely.
Yeah. So I guess my takeaway is that, hey, infidelity comes in many forms for different people. And also, like, monogamous relationships, it's not like, it doesn't provide everything that you need in emotional, physical, mental needs. You may be able to seek it from elsewhere.
Yeah. And I just think we have so much intimacy in so many ways that we don't respect as the same level as our romantic partner. Like, you can have a friend who you have way more of an intimate relationship with your partner even, but it's different, you know? Like, you don't necessarily want to have sex with them, or you don't necessarily want to sleep next to them every single day, but it's also a love. Yeah. So in my opinion, there's so many different loves that we have, and in some ways they're all kind of equal to each other. There shouldn't necessarily have this hierarchy of, like, your romantic partner is like the top and everything else is not really love.
Right. I kind of want to lead to the next question. Can you share a little bit about what the greatest misconception about Shibari is?
I think the biggest misconception, and this is even among people who want to do it and enjoy doing it, is that you are totally out of control when you get tied. I think this is the biggest thing about BDSM, is people tend to think the submissive, the person, the bottom, the person being tied, is poor, pitiful, a person who's getting exploited, who is going to be traumatized from this experience. But very much, I think the person who was receiving any kind of BDSM play is the person in power. And the person who is basically getting all the attention, right? They're doing, everything is for you in many ways. When we do things with certain power roles, the person who is receiving it has all the power because they can tell you when it ends. They have the information and the knowledge to know whether what you're doing is effective. So you could be, for example, tying someone up and thinking this is very painful, but for them, they don't think that, yeah? And they are the one who receives the information before you, yeah? So even as much as you're doing, you don't fully know what they're experiencing. So I would definitely say a lot of people think to be tied means that you're in some sort of weaker position, but I definitely don't agree with that. I would say the opposite.
Interesting. Do you see any direct benefits of shibari on overall intimate wellness or sexual wellness?
Definitely. I mean, for one, like I said, before I did shibari, I had way more issues with trust, and I had way more issues with intimacy about growing close to people. So one thing that I really enjoy about shibari and has taught me a lot is it's taught me to be very vulnerable with another person. And there's a lot of strength in sharing your vulnerabilities. And that doesn't mean just being tied, that's also the person tying. The more we share things that we have awareness of, such as our limits, things that we don't like, things that we can't take, things that we don't enjoy, things that we found scary, all of these things make you more able to communicate with your partner in a way that's open. Yeah, and the more vulnerable you can be with someone else, the more vulnerable they can be with you. And we break down a lot of our guards with each other. And this makes you closer, right? This builds trust with each other. And I think people who do BDSM practices safely, they're more in the habit of learning how to be self-aware of their limits, for example, or be self-aware of what they want to do and what they're capable of doing and what they want to consent to. But a lot of the times in our normal sex lives, we don't really do this. We don't really have the habit of that, or we leave it to guessing each other's reactions. Whilst when I teach shibari, for example, I teach people to have sessions in a set of three. One, before talking about it, what you want to do, making it clear, any areas that might be sensitive, any areas that you don't want to touch, any things that you do or do not want to do, playing together and using awareness of each other's non-verbals, and at the end giving feedback and taking care of each other, right? Checking in. And I think this is something that is so important, because we know shibari could have some risks if you don't do it, but often people who don't do BDSM, they don't have this practice. So in their sex lives, a lot of issues can come out because you haven't really communicated that much.
It almost sounds like, don't go to a therapist or a sex therapist, just go to a BDSM session. Like, whereas with those therapists, you get a lot of theory and they give you, you know, hypothesis and take this home to work on. You go to a shibari class where you put everything into practice and you're actually urged, where you're forced into putting it into practice.
It's very real. It's very authentic. And that's why I chose to do this. And I thought it's better than making films. It's better than writing. It's better than taking a photograph, because the information is so much more real and present. How you're feeling can't be hidden when you're that close to someone. Yeah, it's a very authentic experience of communication. But also what I like about shibari is it doesn't claim to be anything. So for example, we were talking about this with my own community, of how it compares to, for example, manual therapies such as massage therapy or cupping therapy or things like that. They have claims, right? They have claims like, this will help you with inflammation, this will help your acne, this will help this, this will help this. Shibari doesn't claim to have any scientific evidence of medical benefit to you. Yeah, so anything that you do feel is up to you to feel. I simply just provide you the experience, but I'm not going to say this should make you feel relaxed, this should make you do this, yeah? It's all up to you. So I think this is where it's different from therapy, because it doesn't have any claims. And it also really depends on the person who's going into it. Some people have more self-awareness about this stuff and more interest in this. And some people just want to fulfill a dirty fantasy, you know, that they'd seen on porn. So it's different for everyone.
Another question that comes up, like, for me, and then also for my friends, for a person who's never done it, and for me, it's a little bit up until this conversation, for me, it was also always something that we talked about, but very from the outside. And now I feel very interested or compelled actually to dip my toe into it.
Cool.
What would you advise to people be to dip their toes into exploring this? Is it directly go signing up for a class, or is it maybe watching something online first, or I don't know.
Always, as much as I love the community that I'm around and that I love newcomers to come through, it's definitely important to have some sort of risk awareness whenever you go into BDSM, because as much as there are people who have solid information and they have a lot of concerns about communication and consent and safety, there are a lot of people who don't. Yeah, they do it for their own gain. They do it without really educating themselves on it. So I'd say the most important thing is to really assess the person that you want to do it with. Yeah, so just because someone does BDSM doesn't mean they'll do it well with you. That's really important, especially for people who get excited and they want to dip their toes. I would definitely tell this to a younger version of me who was very curious about all things sexual and would meet up with random strangers. Don't do that. Definitely take your time and get to know someone first. And until you feel like you have an attraction helps, but it's not necessary. You just feel at ease with them. Yeah, there's something comforting about them and trustworthy. You can feel that as well in your intuition. Whether or not they're really experienced or not, that is more important. Yeah. So you can come to events and you can have a look, but it's good to find not only a teacher that makes you feel comfortable, but also a partner. So even if you're super interested and you haven't found that partner, it's okay. Just have patience, because it's better to explore this kind of stuff with people you trust than to just explore it with some random stranger who you don't know, who you're not sure of, you don't know if your communication is that clear with.
Yeah, so I have my own boyfriend right now, so I could come with my boyfriend, for instance, right? That as the person to go with.
Yeah.
I also heard about friends who go. Okay, and then I also have friends that go with their girlfriends, just as a friend thing.
Yeah.
You can do that as well.
Sometimes it's better, because girls are very relaxed about sharing their emotions with each other. And sometimes men still have a lot of this guard about vulnerability. So I have had a lot of experience where people have bought their boyfriend, and their boyfriend was a little like, maybe the girl wanted to tie them, and they're like, I don't know if I want to be tied. And then they come with their girlfriend and they can switch and it's okay. So it really depends on the situation. I have a lot of people who they have a specific friend that they like to only play Shibari with. They don't really have a relationship outside of Shibari. And they have a romantic partner as well, but they just have a Shibari play partner too. So it's really just about finding the right match that works.
I felt that I just gained so much knowledge in the past hour. There's so many doors opening up to me. I don't have a lot of questions open up anymore. One of the last questions here is, what is the one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self? You just gave advice about Shibari, but maybe like overall sexual wellness, sexuality, intimacy.
I definitely say it's important for young people, because there's so much information out there. There already was a lot when I was going through my puberty, but now there's even more. Is that no matter how much stuff that you're seeing around, is really take your time. You don't know if you're going to jump into something too dangerous that will traumatize you. Even if you think it's cool, it's really important when it comes to sexuality to really understand that like whatever fears you have or whatever limits you have, those are all valid and those make you a better sex partner than saying yes to everything. So even if you know the person well, or even if you are meeting up with someone on Tinder for the first time, it's really important to share things that you don't want to do. Yeah, don't feel pressured into doing things. Yeah, I need to keep telling myself that today even. It's really important.
Again, being a female, or maybe also coming from an Asian background again, that you, or maybe even an immigrant background, that you want to, how do you say it? Satisfy people, or don't stir up too much, or be very...
Yeah, I think that's, for me, it's more of a female thing. It's more like, for example, I have a relationship now and my boyfriend is very clear with his boundaries. I really am amazed at how easy it is for him to say no to things and how difficult it is for me, you know? There are so many times where I'm like, maybe. And it's in my head, I mean, no, I don't really like this, but I just feel a bit uncomfortable, or I feel it's a little rude for me to just say, no, I don't want to. Or I feel like I'm a bitch or something, you know? But for men, they don't have that consciousness. They can just be like, no, don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. But we didn't talk about the super interesting topic of sex work. Is there anything that you want to share with us and our audience?
So definitely, I think for the first part, for many people who do shibari professionally, it is sex work. It is very much sex work. What you're dealing with is someone's body being intimate with each other. You're giving yourself over for an hour, your time, your labor, your sexual energy too. A lot of people, they go into shibari sessions as well with an intention to get horny. So shibari in itself can be a sex work. Yeah. But I think before... It's very hard to make what I do, like teaching classes, doing sessions that is not specifically to make people horny, and doing performances to make it a living. So even though I wanted to focus on this, it's not an easy job to do. And because my brain was so focused on this, it was very hard for me to go into doing a lot of normal work for a long time. Every time I took another job and try to have a vanilla life with my shibari life, I would end up quitting because I couldn't focus on it and I couldn't be a good worker because my mind was elsewhere, or I couldn't work overtime because I'm going to teach a class or I'm going to do an event. So it became very hard for me to balance that. So definitely early on, before shibari became a more solid experience, is whenever I went traveling, for example, like if I'd run out of money, the quickest thing for me to do was often to go on Craigslist or go on some sort of website for dating and know that I could get a date who could help me financially. So definitely I learned from a young age is that women have a sexual value, and that value can be monetized, right? And I think that is something that is so specific to women. It's like a young boy in trouble, the first thought they wouldn't have is, how can I whore myself out? But a woman always knows that they are valued sexually. And I'd always known that as well as a kid. If you wear something nice or anything and you get catcalled, people want to ask you out, or people try to win you over with nice things on a date. So I always learned, like, this could be an option. This is a way to keep me safe. If there's any time I'm in trouble, there's always some man who could pay for me. So,
because in a way it keeps you safe, but also doesn't it feel dangerous?
It is. It does feel dangerous, but I think it's more a lot of girls, young girls, and they need quick money. It is the quickest way that you can get it sometimes, you know, just being able to talk sweetly and to joke along with someone in a date and then happen to bring the conversation of like, oh, that you're struggling a little bit. And yeah, it's much more common than we think. And a lot of times we've fallen into this without even realizing that what we did is sex work.
At the end of those dates, what are your feelings? Do you feel empowered? Do you feel slight shame? What is that you feel?
It depends. I mean, I had like a range of different things, and a lot of times this would happen when I was in Japan. So I was also around sex workers who work as hosts and hostesses, people who work at shibari bars, BDSM bars. So to me, like, sex workers are not a separate thing in my life. Like, it's definitely connected. It just depends on who I was seeing. So there were some situations where, like, I knew I was dating because I was desperate for money and I didn't want to get it the hard way. And I felt really icky. I felt really gross. And there were some situations where I did feel empowered. So at one point in my life, when I went to Japan and I got broke again, is I started financially dominating. So what I did was I just made a Twitter account where I would just tell people they're stupid and make them like, you're my piggy bank, you're an asshole, you're an idiot, you're my slave. Just basically be really rude to people and take pictures of my feet, take pictures of me in my underwear, and people would just send me money through PayPal.
This is the older version of, what is it, OnlyFans, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the early, like, we just used Twitter back then. But it was hard work. And that's when I was like, sex work is work. Like, I had to constantly keep updating statuses, had to constantly keep channeling specific people if they're like, oh, I want to be your slave, and just being really rude to them and coming up with creative ways to tell them, give me your money, give me your money. And it's hard because you don't know how much to expect, right? So you have to keep doing it until you get enough money. It could be like $20 here and there. So it is work. And some people get really good at it. Like, they really channel a persona. It's basically like some sort of influencer for strange people who like to just give their money away.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was empowering in some ways for me, because I was like, I actually have to work on my social media feed. I have to learn how to be interesting as a persona. And it taught me a lot in that way, but I also realized that didn't suit me. Like, I'm not really that person. I'm not really very good at being online. So it was interesting. I definitely say a lot of my experiences were interesting, but a lot of them I did just out of a position of desperation too.
Did it ever turn out to be a bad decision, or did it have any, like, a bad outcome, or?
I definitely think it did distort my idea of relationships. I got so used to the idea of seeing dating as a way of working that it was very hard for me to date normally, you know, or it was very hard for me to be able to, for example, I can be very good on a date if I know I'm getting paid. Like, I'll dress nice, I'll put nice makeup on, I'll laugh at your jokes, I'll be like your best friend. And then it's fake, right? Because it's work. You're putting on a role because I'm trying to get money out of you. So it kind of started to distort my idea of, like, romance being something transactional. Yeah. And for a long time, like, I couldn't date after that. I was like, I don't know how to do it.
But it happens at most dates. You dress up, you be beautiful, you go out with a guy or girl, and then you laugh, even though they're not funny, and you try to make a good impression.
Right, exactly. We're all doing it to some ways, but I did it with a very clear intention that I'm getting money out of this. And it's just a thing that I don't think is exclusive to making money out of it, right? It's like we think of dating as that sometimes we forget how to be ourselves and forget that we can open up and show our flaws, and that's how you actually get to know people better. But I got so used to that because it's also a way of creating a barrier between you and the person, is that you don't really know me. Like, I'm just putting on a role for you so that this is my job.
I need to distill all of this. There's so much information here now also on my side, but it's super interesting, this conversation.
Yeah, and a lot of girls do this without knowing, like, for example, trophy wives, right? And it's very common in a lot of relationships where men are paying and women are not paying. And it's not something because women just are lazy. It's because this is the way that we have survived a lot of the times through history. You know, a lot of women have not had the same access that men have, or the same abilities to be able to get the same kind of work and the same kind of pay. So it makes sense that we've learned how to use our art of conversation, we've learned how to work on our beauty, we've learned how to work on the way we dress in order to help us survive in life.
Yeah. Definitely, you see it as everywhere. I feel actually you see it as even more in, and maybe I'm generalizing again, in Asia or in China for the years that I lived there. Like, yeah. There's still this entire construct of the man takes care of the family and you just...
It's a very Asian concept of the man being the provider. Yeah. So I think the main thing is like it used to be like this everywhere, but there has been a lot of progress, I would say, in the Europe and in ways that a lot of places in Asia just haven't reached that point yet.
I feel that we're trying to evolve from that though, right now with our roles as women in society, whereas we're being taught to adhere to the men and take care of the men, that now there's this entire group standing up of girl power, girl bosses, girls doing the shit that they want to do and not being influenced by what a guy wants or what the guy can have over girls.
Yeah, definitely. Women are getting much more autonomy now.
Yeah.
I guess now it's just about more about choice, right? Like either way, you can be independent if you want. Now we have more options to be independent. We can choose to be independent. We can choose not to be independent. Or in a relationship, we want to get more financially. Then we provide more, maybe in some other senses, whether it's taking more of the household, taking care of the kids more.
Which is a lot of work.
Yeah, which is a lot of work. It's like mom, like house moms is also, like it should be paid as well. So I'd say, yeah, definitely. I just think there's more options for women as opposed to only being in the receiving role of waiting to get paid by the husband.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely agree with you there. It's like we did have like a major phase, like for example, like guerrilla feminism of the 90s, where people became very angry and very determined to like live the corporate life and do as a man does. But it's the main idea is now we should get to the progress where we all have the choice of how we want to be. Like you don't have to be a specific girl boss to feel like an empowered, strong woman. We can accept when people, for example, if they do sex work or if they're a housewife, that they can also be seen as a strong woman. Yeah, there are so many different ways that people can make these choices. And there are so many different types of work and effort that we put into life that is not necessarily equal to how we would see men.
All right.
Thank
Thanks
you
so much.
Thanks so much, Hua Hua.
Great talking to you.